today we're going to talk about how to handle questions and responses in interviews live. And I've got two guests joining us. One is from Visit Milwaukee. Those of you who are at the Women in Travel Summit might be familiar with Kristen Settle. She's going to be joining us very shortly. And just a quick word of warning. When the guests join us on the call, there is no way for me to mute them or moderate when they come in and out of the call. So when they dial in, they'll just be there suddenly. So I might be in the middle of saying something, and then we'll magically be joined by somebody else. So just be prepared for that. So today we're going to talk about, first we're going to go over just very quickly some of the best practices for interview calls. And I'm going to explain to you what the topics for the calls today are. I've proposed kind of sample fake stories that I would be doing about these destinations for each of our guests today. And they know that these are sample stories, not necessarily stories I'm actually doing, but I might actually do them in the future. But just for the purposes of this call, I've matched story ideas to specific markets. And then we're going to have Kristen from Visit Milwaukee, and then we will have Stephen from Travelling County, which is around Eugene, which is south of Portland, Oregon. So that's who's going to be joining us. But just to quickly recap, at its core, an interview is a conversation. It's a question and listening to the answer. It's not about having specific questions that you know that you want to ask, so much as building trust and then through that trust, gaining the information that you need to accomplish your goal, which is creating an interesting piece for your readers. And so in that vein, background on the destination and the story that you want to tell is much more important in terms of preparing for your interview than spending time formulating specific questions. And in terms of questions, a couple of my favorites are the layman approach, or as I like to call it, if somebody didn't know about this, what's the most important thing that they would need to know? And so I'm going to do that with one of our guests for you today. And again, in an interview, it's not so much about the questions as much as the interaction, because that is how you're going to get the best quotes, because the point of an interview is not just to get information, you can find that online, but it's to get quotes in particular. And you accomplish that by not overloading the interviewee with questions and interrupting what they're going to say. And my favorite question to wrap up with is always, what else that we haven't talked about would somebody who wants to know about this topic need to know? So today when Kristen dials into the call, I think that might be her. Kristen, are you there?
I am.
Oh, brilliant. You came in right when I was talking. So pretend you didn't hear this, and we'll start our actual interview in 1 second. So for the call with Kristen, this is a place that I've been, as I mentioned, and we're going to be talking about places, some of which I have been and some of which I haven't. And this is for an article that would be a high-level overview of the destination with a specific angle, in this case, the Maker Movement in Milwaukee, for something like American Way, which has a section which is a trend piece around food on a specific destination. So Kristen's here, so let's go ahead and get started. Kristen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And I realized that I didn't mention this in too much detail in our email setting up this call, but the piece that I'm discussing today will be sort of a high-level overview in brief, so about 350, 450 words about, as I mentioned, the Maker Movement in the food scene in Milwaukee and how visitors can take advantage of it.
Great.
So to start, I'd love for you to tell me, as I mentioned in the email, a little bit about how this got started. I've been there and I visited some of these places, but what's the timeline? When did you start to see this shift to the small craft-oriented food businesses?
Well, the truth is that Milwaukee has been a maker city since before it was founded as a city. Our first settlers came with their knowledge of how to brew good beer from Germany. Mm-hmm. They came with their knowledge of how to tan hides. They came with the steel working knowledge. So we've always been a city of makers. Mm-hmm. It's just evolved over time from these large-scale makers. Now we're back to small scale. It's almost in a pendulum. So I mean, even Miller Brewing Company was a small beer company at one point before it became the conglomerate that it is now. Mm-hmm. And see the revival of the craft brewers again just kind of shows you that we've kind of hit the other end of that bell curve. So it's really mm-hmm. interesting to see how makers in Milwaukee have shaped the city and are continuing to do so now.
And I love what you just said about how it's interesting to see how they're continuing to shape the city. I know when I was there, we visited, I believe Walker's Point was, is that the right name of the neighborhood that's kind of up and coming?
Yep, that is.
Yeah. And so as you were just saying, how these sort of craft companies are shaping the landscape of the city, what are some areas, Walker's Point or otherwise, that have had a revitalization because of these small businesses?
I think most of Milwaukee's neighborhoods have seen that. So Milwaukee itself is a rather large city in terms of mileage or square miles and population, but it's known as a city of neighborhoods. So oftentimes we locals refer to different districts of the city by their neighborhoods. So the one you're referring to now is Walker's Point, and that is just south of downtown. It is adjacent to the main heart of downtown. I would say maybe 15, 20 years ago, it was a rather desolate place. It home to a lot of factories, but not a lot of homes or people or small companies. And about 10 years or so ago, people started moving back to that area and investing in the city. And one of the biggest investors in Walker's Point is a chef named Dave Swanson. And he is a James Beard chef, and he opened Braise Restaurant. And he really started this restaurant-supported agriculture program here in Milwaukee. And that then launched dozens of other businesses who benefit from that. And Dave really has much more than a farm-to-table approach. His approach is really rooftop-to-table. So he grows a lot of his own vegetables and herbs on the roof of the restaurant. He holds his culinary classes in the restaurant. You can go up to the roof and you can pick your own veggies and herbs that you might need for the recipe. He really tries to source everything within 50 miles of Milwaukee, which is obviously pretty easy to do, seeing as we're not that far away from some fantastic farmland. And then what's I think more important is that he reached out to other local restaurants and other local purveyors who were in town and said, let's work together. And because of Braise's efforts, we have seen a huge surge in restaurants, in craft breweries, and in locally owned stores in Walker's Point, all within like a 1 mile walk of this Braise restaurant. So the two that come to top of mind is a place called Purple Door Ice Cream, which was started in 2009, I believe, by a husband and wife with a couple small children, and they wanted to own an ice cream shop. They had actually talked about it on their very first date together that they were going to own ice cream.
Oh, that's so
Yeah, and
sweet.
then they got married and had a baby and decided that was the perfect time to start your own business.
Of course.
But they opened up Purple Door Ice Cream. Now, Purple Door uses the milk that comes from the Milwaukee County Zoo,
Oh my
which
gosh.
is 5 miles outside of downtown, and the Milwaukee County Zoo has the only working dairy farm inside of Milwaukee County. And they have about, I'd say, two dozen, three dozen cows there, so it's not very big. The dairy farm isn't, the zoo is rather large. But the dairy farm isn't very big, but Purple Door uses that milk to make their ice cream. Purple Door also reaches out to other area stores and purveyors to help get ingredients for their ice cream. So, for example, just down the street from Purple Door is a place called Clock Shadow Creamery, which is the only urban dairy in Milwaukee as well. Clock Shadow Creamery also uses the milk from the Milwaukee County Zoo. They make this fantastic cheese called Quark, which is somewhere between a cream cheese and a goat cheese. So it's tangy and it has a fantastic texture to it. Well, Purple Door uses the Quark cheese from Clock Shadow in an ice cream flavor called Mint Quark.
And is the
You
mint
wouldn't.
from Braise?
The mint is from Braise. Yeah, the mint leaves
Oh,
come from
amazing.
Braise, from other areas around, from other growers around the area, as well as Purple Door grows a lot of their own stuff. But then the quark comes from Clock Shadow. And the same thing, any quark that Braise uses in its restaurants also comes from Clock Shadow. And then going up the street from Purple Door a little bit more is Central Standard Distillery and Great Lakes Distillery. And so at Great Lakes Distillery, they brew something called Kinnikinick Whiskey. Kinnikinick is one of the rivers that runs through Milwaukee. And so Purple Door Ice Cream uses the Kinnikinick whiskey in its whiskey ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody is benefiting from each other and using each other's resources to really revitalize this area. And there's been a huge growth in not only the number of people moving back to the area, condos being built, supermarkets being put in, but then also this small mom-and-pop shops of creameries, breweries, distilleries, James Beard restaurants. We have two James Beard restaurants that are right across the street from each other in Walker's Point. And it's just really cool to see because they're so different, but the chefs are best friends, which is really great.
And is that Braise and something else?
Yeah, it's Braise in a place called Circa 1880.
Oh, right.
Which serves French food, and it's owned by Chef Thomas Hawk.
And I just wanted to expand on what you were saying about how they play off of each other, and that has really allowed for growth in the neighborhood. Are there, what are the benefits, apart from sort of the goodwill that that these companies have seen from working together? Do they cross promote to their customers? Do they find some savings for the companies? What is the benefit aside from the values? I know you mentioned the restaurant agriculture program. Is that kind of like a shared buying program?
It is. It would be like some sort of community supported agriculture program that you have in a lot of cities. But here, the restaurant supported agriculture program, and they benefit that way. They cross promote each other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
See at Purple Door Ice Cream that it says Kinnikinick Whiskey from Great Lakes Distillery. You'll see that it says that the beer that is in their beer and pretzels ice cream comes from the Milwaukee Brewing Company.
Mm-hmm.
We will host street festivals together. I know that we just had Garlic Fest here.
Next question was your festivals and how that ties in. Thanks. Yeah.
Yeah. So we had just had Garlic Fest here in Milwaukee and Walker's Point outside of Braise. So they all come together and promote each other. They will co-host dinners together and events. And it's really great because let's say, for example, you're trying to get a reservation at Braise or at another great place called Morel, which is down the street, or Movida, and if they can't fit you in, they'll recommend another place in
Washington.
So there's not the same competition, that you would normally see. Everybody kind of treats each other like family, and because we recognize that a rising tide lifts all boats.
And we've been talking a lot about food, and you mentioned beer and the whiskey as well. And I was actually really impressed. Obviously, everyone thinks of Milwaukee as a beer city, and I know that there's a lot of craft beer there. But I was really impressed by the distillery scene as well. And especially I visited Bitter Cube Bitters, which is co-located with both a distillery and a brewery. So how are these kind of collaborations working within the more drinkable scene?
They're working in much the same way as anything else. So a lot of actually the breweries and the distilleries are both cross-promoting and working together to create flavors. So Bitter Cube is a great example, started in 2009 by a couple friends, and they will sell their bitters to ice cream shops. They will sell their bitters to distilleries to create specialty cocktails. They'll sell them to restaurants. They'll partner actually with Lakefront Brewery or with Milwaukee Brewing Company to create unique and special blends. So everybody is really working off of the talent that we already have here in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And I think that that makes Milwaukee really great, this huge maker history and sense of pride and ownership that we have instilled in us to stay local, keep it local, and use the local resources that we have.
Mm-hmm. And I know you talked about how Dave from Braise had really kind of supported the growth of this culture, but is there an official incubator program of any kind? How do new businesses that are starting today, how do they make use of these other resources?
I don't think that there's a specific incubator program for the restaurants, but everybody is so interconnected. The chefs know each other so well that if you were to come to Milwaukee to try to break in, they would help. That they make themselves available. They have conversations about suggestions or holes that there might be, or if you wanted to come in and start a pizza place, they might recommend, hey, talk to Clock Shadow about their mozzarella or their quark or whatever it happens to be. So It's a really good natured place to be. Everyone really nurtures this maker culture that we have, and we actually have two, speaking of festivals, we actually have two maker fairs in Milwaukee each year. One is called Maker Fair, and the other one is called Hovercraft.
Okay.
And it's just a group of people who get together because they're all makers and craftsmen who want to learn from each other, to showcase each other's hobbies, to just really build on that creativity and that resourcefulness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as we're talking about this, I see that this would also be a great piece for Plate, which is more of a restaurant industry mm-hmm. trade publication. So I'm going to look into that a little bit more and talk to you about that later as well. So we had talked briefly about festivals, but I just wanted to pivot over. And obviously, you guys have one of the, I think it's the largest festival in the world. Is that right? Summerfest?
Summerfest is the world's largest music festival. It opened yesterday, and it runs through July 9th. And it celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. It's been around since 1967. It is iconic. It is everything that is wonderful about Milwaukee: craft food, craft beer, locals, visitors. It's set on 76 permanent acres on Milwaukee's lakefront. You get stunning views of the lake wherever you go. It has 11 permanent stages. And the acts that come are some of the best in the world, and you can see them for free.
Mm-hmm.
It's a $20 ticket to get in if you have to pay for a ticket, but there's so many freebie promotions that I don't know anybody pays full price for a ticket anymore. But the acts that you can just walk to side stages and see people like Willie Nelson, Sheryl Crow, Pink, the Bodines, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Dirk Bentley, Luke Bryan, I mean, Ludacris. I mean, it just goes on and on.
So how does that, obviously I'm sure you serve the local food, but are there any kind of additional things that are happening, like these chef dinners that you were talking about? How does the food scene work into Summerfest?
So a lot of the food that is served at Summerfest is all locally owned. Like mm-hmm. you're not going to find a McDonald's stand on the Summerfest ground.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All locally owned restaurants that are serving, traditional Milwaukee favorites like deep fried cheese curds or fish fries, and then some of them get a little bit more creative on a stick. But everything
is on a stick these days.
Yeah, everything is on a stick these days. But yeah, it's all, and the beer is local, so it's really nice.
Mm-hmm.
This true Milwaukee experience, and that really. We consider Summerfest almost like the kickoff of the festival season, but it's actually the third or fourth that we have in the summer. We have Pride Fest in the beginning of summer. We have Polish Fest at the beginning of summer. And then we go through all of our ethnic festivals, Festa Italiana, German Fest, Irish Fest, which is the world's largest Celtic festival. We have the Wisconsin State Fair. We have Mexican Fiesta. We have Bastille Days. We have Indian Summer. It goes on and on and on.
And you know, they're
just in the summer months. We have 30 festivals just in the 100 days of summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was going to say, I know that Milwaukee is kind of known for a certain immigrant, I guess, population, but you do have quite a few. I was really intrigued to find out about the Hispanic population in Walker's Point and the history there. And I think when you were talking about the festivals, it really highlighted something that I've noticed when I've been to Milwaukee, which is that it's not what you think. There's so much more going on. And so just to kind of close out, I'd love for you to tell me your kind of one takeaway that you would want somebody who hasn't been to Milwaukee and is thinking about a trip. What would you really like them to know?
I think I want them to know that Milwaukee is going to surprise them.
Mm-hmm.
That whatever impression they have of Milwaukee or whatever lack of impression that they have, they need to see it for themselves. We hear time and again from leisure tourists, from convention goers, from parents of university students that they had no idea Milwaukee mm-hmm. was so cool. And it's not just the summer months. We are a 12-month destination, and our data, our tourism data shows us that people are coming here year-round for what we have going on.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've never been to Milwaukee before, I promise you that you are going to be shocked mm-hmm. at what you see. there is something fun to do, beautiful to see, delicious to eat. You know, it goes on and on and on. I mean, and we haven't even touched on, you know, the lakefront, all of our fantastic museums, our world-class theater. You know, there's 100,000 university students in Milwaukee. I mean, this is just, this is a cool place to be.
Yeah, and I think that definitely shows in the food scene, which is why I'm very excited to highlight it, to sort of intro people into that side of Milwaukee. So I'm so glad that you were able to join me today. I knew Summerfest was coming, and I had a feeling it was right now, and I didn't check the dates, but I'm very happy that we were able to make the timing work today, and give my thanks to Emily for that as well.
Yeah, I will do that. And if you need any more information about Milwaukee, of course, our website is visitmilwaukee.org.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Kristen, and have a great holiday weekend as well.
Thanks. You too.
See you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, guys, so that was Kristen Settle from Visit Milwaukee. And in just a minute, we're going to have Stephen join us from Travel Lane County. And as I mentioned, that is going to be the area around Eugene. It's south of Portland. And I'm going to ask him a little bit to expand on what he covers in terms of the geographic area as well. Stephen, are you with us already?
Yeah, hey there, Gabby. Just hopped on. How's it going?
Oh, hi. Great. Good. Okay, I'm just hold 1 second. You just came 1 minute early. I was just transitioning over from Kristen's call. So you're going to hear me tell our listeners what you and I are about to talk about, but just put on earmuffs for 1 moment. So I met Stephen at a tourism conference, the Travel and Words Conference in northwestern part of the country, if any of you guys were there. And so I've spoken with him before, and we talked about a particular trip that I wanted to do, but I haven't been to his destination. So this is going to be a different type of interview than what I did with Kristen, where I know Milwaukee, I've been there several times, I'm familiar with the major attractions. And as a result, and I do get a lot of questions from you guys about this, how do you do an interview before a trip or for a place that you haven't been? So that's what we're going to be highlighting in here. And the type of story that I'm going to be talking to Stephen about is I do, as I mentioned, have a trip coming up, but the specific story that I want to ask him about in this interview is for an audience who would be coming from Portland, either they're based there or they might be coming in to experience Portland and the food scene, but want to also get out and do some active things in the greater area. What are some great day trips or weekend trips that they can add on, or like I said, for people who live in Portland to come down? So, Stephen, thanks so much for joining us and for making the timing work. I really appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, thanks for the awesome intro there. Happy to talk about the destination a little bit and some day trip ideas.
Yeah, so I'd love for you to refresh me, because I know we talked about it and you had a very excellent map with you, so I can visualize kind of in my head the area that we're talking about, but I just want to make sure as I'm asking you questions I have the right geographic boundaries. So what do you encompass?
Absolutely, yeah. So we're here with Lane County. We cover everything from Eugene, which is just about 2 hours south of Portland on I-5. Going east, we go up into the Cascades mountain range. So that covers the McKenzie River area, just south of that, the Oak Ridge area. That kind of goes just up to the mountain pass that you would go over to visit Bend.
So we're just
west of that. And then going west from Eugene, we go all the way over into the Oregon coast. Covering Florence, and then up to almost to Yahats, and just a little bit south of Florence, too, in the Dune City area. So it's kind of, you know, we're at the southern tip of the Willamette Valley. We've got the Oregon Cascades. We also have a good chunk of the Oregon coast in our area, too.
I know. That's the thing, is you just have everything. You have all the good stuff, don't you?
Oh, a lot of different kinds of environments to see and a lot of good food to check out, for sure.
Yeah. And so, I didn't specifically put this in my email when we were talking about the angles, but I assume that you guys do have a bit of the Willamette wine country area and also some of the Oregon coast wines as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Definitely with the South Willamette Valley, we've got the South Willamette Wineries Association. So there are about 23 different wineries to see down here just outside of Eugene. There's a little wine trail that we like to call the Territorial Wine Trail because it's on the Territorial Highway. It's just west of Eugene.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's kind of makes for a nice tour kind of out in the country, but you can also come into Eugene and get a cool taste of some of the urban wineries we have there.
And why is the Territorial Highway, what does that name come from?
You know, I can't recall exactly why they named it. I know it relates a little bit to the folks that first came in on wagons, you know, in terms of like that was the highway that they took to kind of
get
through the valley there. But
yeah,
they've got it's now dotted, you know, kind of as wine country. So there are quite a few different spots to visit through that trip. It's a pretty quick drive too, about 45 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because that was my next question. Because I know with anytime there's a wine trail, you get into the driving issue, and particularly if people are coming down from the city, either because they've come in from abroad and they've flown into Portland, or if they just live in Portland and don't own a car. What are some of the transit options for people who want to do, whether it's the wine trail or get out to the Cascades or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the ways we like to talk about it a lot is, Eugene has its own airport, and so it's a popular fly-in, fly-out destination for folks that are starting in Portland, maybe, flying into Portland and then doing some of the wineries that you'll see in like the Yamhill Valley area, some of the northern Wolf Valley wineries. And from there, they can actually drive down Highway 99 for a pretty cool kind of scenic view of the Willamette Valley, and you'll end up at the Territorial Highway. You can, it's pretty easy to make that link. And then, from there you can kind of check out a few of the South Willamette wineries and fly out of the Eugene Airport if you wanted to. So it makes kind of a nice fly in, fly out. We also have Amtrak in Eugene. So that's another popular way for folks to kind of, take the train down, and then you'll be right in the hub of the city. You can from there take your bike, or arrange different tours with some of the different wine tour companies we have, like Cork and Barrel is a popular one we do a
Right, I
couple.
remember you had mentioned that one to me. And in terms of the wine tours, are there any of note that are particularly unusual? Like, I only just thought of this, but like, is there a cannabis and wine tour, or is there something specific either to your area or just a really interesting provider?
Yeah, no cannabis and wine tours yet that I know of, but the
I'm
one
sure
that we
it's
like to talk
coming.
about, I bet so. One that we like to talk about a lot is, you get some really interesting tours from the folks at King Estate, who they're the biggest producer of Pinot Gris in the nation, and they also were just certified biodynamic. So it's
Oh, great. Oh, wow.
got some big news from those guys. So I've done a couple
I'm
of tours
making
with
that
them.
in big bold for myself because I want to make
Yes.
sure to check that out when I'm down there. Because biodynamic
Absolutely.
wine is kind of starting to have a moment, but people for a long time just thought it smelled weird. Have you ever noticed how biodynamic wine smells kind of like rotten eggs or something?
A little different, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Okay. So they have their own tours of the property, or do they also partner with other wineries?
Yeah, of the property itself, but they do, the nice thing about our South Willamette wineries is that they do work together pretty well. So a lot of the tour companies will put together little group tours, and the ones on the Territorial Highway down here are fairly close together, so it makes it pretty easy to kind of make your own little tour out of it. But also, if you wanted to get the whole behind the scenes kind of look, it's pretty easy to get into some of the smaller shops and get a tour from the folks that own it.
Okay, great. And so are there ones in particular that are sort of reservation only? So if you want to visit these places, they're great, but you need to make sure to call in advance.
Most of them are wide open. I can't
Okay,
really think
great.
of any that, in terms of, visiting the wineries. Some of the smaller ones, in terms of getting tours from those guys, you definitely want to check in on. But I know King Estate does actually tours on the hour, on the weekend, so fairly accommodating.
And so, if you're coming down and you want to do the wine trail, what are the food options in there? I imagine some of the larger wineries might have restaurants, or otherwise, are there other things out there to check out?
Absolutely, yeah. King Estate has a wonderful restaurant down there. So that's a good one that we kind of like to hook as, like, if you're doing a tour, maybe you end there, and get a nice dinner before you head back to town. Also a great spot for lunch. But a lot of the wineries are actually doing what some of the breweries are doing with different food carts.
Oh, great.
And so there are a few in the north part of the Territorial Highway and a couple in the south part as well that will have, regular hours with food carts now. But they're also close to town that we also like to talk about different pairings that you can make with. We talked a little bit about our Pinot Bingo program, which is kind of a fun way to explore wine country down here and also earn prizes by getting stamps at the wineries. On that program, there are also a couple of pairing stamps that will earn you like additional bingo card slots. So it kind of lays out a few different restaurants that are really, really friendly in terms of offering different wines that pair well with the food. So it's
Oh,
kind of a
great.
nice way to make a trip out of that.
Cool. So let's kind of shift. I guess maybe we'll do coast and then we'll go to the mountains. So in terms of the coast outside of the wine country, what's a good sort of compact like day trip or weekend trip that you would say really highlights the offerings over there?
Absolutely, yeah. In Florence, it's kind of a unique area of the coast because we have the Oregon Dunes National Recreation Area there, which has, dozens of miles of massive dunes to check out. And so it's kind of a unique stop because you can visit Florence's Old Town, which is a pretty cute little downtown area that's nestled right up next to the Siuslaw River. And so that gets you a really good you know, a little taste of some boutique kind of coastal shopping with some really nice restaurants. So you can get a nice like breakfast, lunch, or dinner there. From there, you can go just south of Florence on 101 and experience some of the dunes. On the dunes themselves, you know, there's sand dune buggies that are out there. You can get some tours from those guys, and they're pretty fast and pretty wild. lot of fun.
Dress appropriately. Also,
yeah, you know, get ready for a little bit of sand. The sandboarding is actually a big part of what's going on in Florence. And I know, you know, a few people know about sandboarding, but it is a kind of a cool sport that's not quite, you know, big mainstream yet.
And who does that really appeal to? Who's the main audience for that right now?
Yeah, you know, it's surprising because it really does reach a lot of different age ranges. It's a very friendly thing to pick up and try. You know, you're on a board and you kind of have a little bit of wax that you wax the bottom of the board with, but depending on how comfortable you feel with it, you can take all sorts of different kinds of hills with it, you know, in terms of the size of the dunes. The shop over there called Sandmaster Park is, I believe it's the first sandboarding park, you know, in the world. The gentleman that owns it, Lon Beale, is a godfather of the sport. And so it's a pretty unique spot to be able to kind of go in, take the family. You can get lessons from, like, world champions.
To
work in this park here. And then from there, you can rent a board and go south. You know, they have their own dunes that are kind of in the back of the facility, but if you wanted to, you could rent a board for longer and then just go explore the dunes just south of Florence, like, all day. Kind of
That's
a fun way
cool.
to, you know, and you can camp or you can stay in Old Town. There are a lot of really great hotel options around the Florence area there. But that's kind of like, you know, in the around downtown kind of an area. From there, you can also go north on Highway 101, and it's one of my favorite stretches of the coast in terms of drives. You get that really cool, rocky Oregon coastline, right? And, you know, there are a couple of attractions that are really cool to check out along there, like the Sea Lion Caves, which is kind of a popular stop. Largest natural sea cave formation in the U.S., so it's a pretty cool, interesting thing to see. Just north of that, there's the Hasita Head Lighthouse, too, which is the most photographed lighthouse in Oregon. Reportedly, the B&B that's attached to it is haunted.
I had heard that it was romantic, so apparently I...
It's very romantic. It's very romantic. The ghost is apparently the one of the or a wife of one of the lighthouse keepers there. So
oh, really?
Kind of interesting. Yeah, fun little hook. But it is a beautiful property. The lighthouse keepers inn is kind of just down a little hike from the lighthouse there, and it is gorgeous. Little, I think it's a five-bedroom house, but it is where the lighthouse keepers used to stay, you know, before electricity was in the area, and they would have to go relight the lighthouse every I think it was every 4 hours. So definitely a job to keep up on. But now it's an amazing place to visit and to hike. There are a couple of different hikes that you can go up to the lighthouse and around the back of the lighthouse. So really scenic, cool viewpoint up there. And if you kept going north on 101, you would find like Devil's Churn, which is a really amazing rock formation that the water has, you know, it's flown, it's kind of flowing inward, and it's created a little channel that has the water kind of stirring around. And just above that is the Cape Perpetua Lookout, which is an amazing spot to kind of get above all the trees and get a really cool view of the Siuslaw National Forest and pretty much the south coastline. So a lot of really cool
sites. The perfect photo spot, basically, right? Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing, yeah. So it's kind of just a snapshot of like some of the things up in the coast. We also have the Siuslaw River that flows inland from there. And there's a lot of really great like fishing opportunities there. The other thing that Florence has that I think a lot of people kind of forget about is all of the flatwater lakes that are around the area. There are seven that are easy to kayak and kind of float on. And so it makes it kind of interesting. You know, on one side of 101, you've got the ocean. On the other side, you have these lakes that are, like, really close to town. So a lot of interesting recreation opportunities for folks.
And I know, actually, the person I know who had stayed at the lighthouse had gone in the winter, and that's a very different experience. How much in terms of the kayaking and the sandboarding, are these things all year round?
Yeah, you know, it is pretty easy to do those sports all year round. The challenge with sandboarding is that if the sand is really wet, then it works. And if the sand is really dry, it works. If it's in between, it's a little bit more challenging. But they have developed a, you know, like a dry sand wax and a wet sand wax.
Okay.
So that way you kind of have some options. But we've gone out even if it's kind of misted over a little bit, and it makes it a little bit challenging to get out there, but it's still, you can still, ride the dunes all right. You just won't get quite as fast,
Okay, that's a great tip. Thank you for that. So also, in terms of being very different in the different seasons is the mountains. And so I know we have talked a little bit about the ski opportunities there, but I'd love to kind of hear season by season, what are the highlights of your parts of the Cascade in terms of activities and destinations?
Absolutely, yeah. In spring and summertime, we like to talk about some of the waterfalls that you can see out in the Cascade. So it kind of frames them a little differently, right? In the spring and summer, you get a lot of the kind of the fresh runoff. The Mackenzie River flows from an aquifer basin, and there is snow melt that's also in that. But since there's a basin that holds like 7 years of water underground, you know that the waterfalls are going to be flowing pretty well. And then when you add snow melt on top of that, it can be pretty amazing, when it starts to melt in the spring and early summer. So we have a series of waterfalls to check out that are really amazing in that spring and summertime, but also in the fall, you get some really unique views with those. We have the fall foliage along Highway 126, and up into that area has a lot of vine maples with it. So when those start to change color, it's really interesting because you get the waterfall up against like the lush green and the Douglas National, the Doug firs that are in the Willamette National Forest, the Umpqua National Forest. And those are such like a vibrant green, but right in front or behind those, you'll have those vine maples turning like yellow, bright orange, little red in there. And so it makes for a really interesting kind of fall foliage experience up there.
Yeah, because usually it's kind of one or the other, but you can't get both in the same viewpoint.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting view to see that mixture like that.
And did you say they're called vine maples, like grapevine?
Yeah. Vine maples are the popular ones that are kind of, they actually run all the way from parts of the coast along 126 as you come inward. That's kind of the main highway that connects all the way from the coast through Eugene and Springfield and into the Cascades region there.
Okay, cool.
Along that route, you'll see a lot of vine maples popping. But yeah, a lot of the hikes, we've got waterfall hikes that are really popular during that time. But also, fishing in the Mackenzie River area especially is phenomenal. The wooden drift boats that are actually Mackenzie River drift boats developed for the river.
And is that because of the current or the depth? Why do they need a specific boat for that river?
Yeah, there's the speed of the flow kind of picks up quickly and kind of slows down in parts. And so they wanted a boat that would kind of float a little bit differently and really be able to navigate rocks well. And so a lot of the guides that are on the river actually, have relation to folks that developed the boats,
Oh, wow.
So that's a really cool way to see the river, like pairing up with different guides that we have. They're also knowledgeable, and it's such an interesting experience to ride with them because they can just manipulate the boat like no big deal, just little tweaks with the paddles and things. It's always amazing to see how they can handle that. But they're also, a lot of really amazing fly fishing opportunities and some steelhead and salmon, and it's a lot of really cool ways, especially to like learn how to do fly fishing too.
Actually what I was going to ask you. If you have never done it and you say, well, this is the area, what are some good opportunities to learn?
Yeah, I mean, that was me. I've always kind of wanted to do fly fishing, but I never learned. And so I actually was out on a photo shoot because we were going to get some photos of folks doing fly fishing, and
you were the
one of those people. Yeah. And so they kind of handed me the pole, and I said, "All right, I've fished before, but I hadn't fly fished." It was so easy to learn from some of the guides on they always talk about the risk control a little bit with fly fishing. And so they just gave me a couple of tips and watched my cast, and soon enough I was like casting like no problem. It was really cool to kind of learn from the pros like that. These guys really know what they're doing. So it's really cool to just get little tips that make a big difference. Made me feel like I knew a little bit like what I was doing.
So
it was kind of nice. But the Mackenzie has a lot of spots where you can kind of fish on the bank.
Okay.
But out in the boat, like when you're out in the river, it's just a different experience. So fresh smelling, and it's great. There's also some, in terms of like water activities up there, rafting is a popular activity. The rapids, I believe, go up to class 3 on the Mackenzie. Mm-hmm. So it's not too intense. You still get like thrown around a little bit, but it's not enough to be a little, intimidating. And the experience from upriver to like the middle part and kind of like a little bit of the lower McKenzie is really cool. It's really different. Like the kind of flow upriver is pretty quick. The water is like really, really cold because it's coming straight out of that aquifer basin, you know.
Right.
And the air is even cleaner than it is downriver because it's just fresh, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of a different experience. And then once you start to get downriver, it slows down a little bit. It's a little bit more, you know, you're going over some rapids and some kind of some waves, you know. But the river is just a little bit bigger in parts, and so.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of my experience with it. It's just, you know, a little bit more relaxed, a little bit more of a chance for you to kind of take in the scenery, whereas upriver, you're moving really quickly. Everything's
more
really,
adventure.
Yeah, a little bit more fun. But there are a lot of parts in the middle and the lower part of the McKenzie that like to rock the boat pretty well. So some of those rapids were pretty fun to face. But yeah, those are some of the summer and springtime activities up there. There are also some hot springs to check out. So,
brilliant. Okay.
Cool little hot spring spots up there. Belknap is a good one where they have, you know, it's actually an established resort, I believe.
And can you go as a day visitor or do you have to stay over?
Yeah, you can go in and just kind of hop in the pool.
Cool.
Their hot springs there actually flow into it's a natural hot spring site that kind of flow into a pool that they have there. So
okay.
It's kind of a, you know, a nice kind of easy way to experience hot springs there. A lot of camping, and they do have some rooms that you can reserve there too.
Okay.
So and a secret gardens too, which is pretty
cool. Oh, okay. Secret how? What's special about it?
Well, there's a little bit of a path you have to take to get there that kind of it feels like you're walking, and you are walking through the forest. You know, you're walking through parts of the national forest up there. But I think it's like a mile, half mile. It's not a long walk, but just from the hot springs there, it's pretty cool. Their site is neat. It's kind of toward the upper part of the McKenzie, so you get to see cool confluence on that hike.
Okay.
But a lot of hikes like that. I mean, the McKenzie River Trail is another one to highlight. It's a
That was my next question, actually, is if you had to pick, like, I know it's going to be hard, and you're not supposed to play favorites because you're with the tourism board, but if you had to pick your top three hikes for people who are just coming for a short while, so maybe not too arduous and not too long, what would you recommend?
Yeah, you know, ones that we like to do, the McKenzie River Trail is really, really cool, and it's massive, so it's a cool one because you can kind of hop on and hop off in a lot of different spots. Makes it pretty easy to experience. So that's one to check out. That, you know, it's a big stretch of the McKenzie, so it's pretty easy to find a leg that you want to check out. It's all along the river too, so it's just gorgeous. Along that, you know, the Sahalian and Coosa waterfalls are just north of kind of one of the main towns in the McKenzie area, and it's a really cool little loop hike. It's only about 3 miles, but you can pull off. There's designated parking. There's a restroom. And a really cool little information kiosk there. But from there, you can get a really cool view at Sahale Falls, which is a beautiful kind of little waterfall that shoots out from the upper McKenzie. And then you can stay on that same trail and hike south about a mile and a half, and you'll land at Coosa Falls, which is a really cool kind of a wider waterfall. So we like to suggest that loop just because it's an easy little hike. And then as you're either coming into the McKenzie or heading back into the Willamette Valley from there, you can stop at a little campsite called Delta. And they have a really cool little, very short, like a half a mile nature trail. And it's a really amazing way to kind of experience a few of the old growth in the area where you see like massive trees and really puts you like right out in the thick of the forest. So that's a favorite one for me because it's just a really quick way to get a good look at that kind of an environment.
And I know you had mentioned, and this was another thing that I wanted to ask you from the seasonal level, about festivals that you guys have. Did you have some specific ones that you wanted to tell me about? I don't have my email in front of me right now.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a few of them that are actually coming right up. So the Country Fair is a very popular one that you know, folks like to talk a lot about. That really cool, kind of artsy, some good food out there. That's actually going on next weekend. That's a pretty cool one to check out for folks that, like I said, are kind of into the artsy thing. It's a cool spot for different families. There are a lot of like kid focused activities. But also some really cool creativity that's going on.
And I feel like with a county fair, I immediately think massive, like hard to park, hard to get around. What are your best tips for kind of making the most of that?
Totally. So this is actually the Oregon Country Fair. Sorry. this and so it's kind of an established Totally different game from like our, because we have our Lane County Fair too, which is a great great fair that's coming right up. But the Oregon Country Fair is kind of, it's out toward the Vinita area, which is just outside of Eugene. But it's a very interesting, unique kind of a vibe, very artsy, very creative, a totally different experience from other kinds of fairs. And that one, but you are right. I mean, in terms of like parking and navigating to it, one thing that I really like what that fair has done is worked with our local transit district really well. And so there are a lot of spots to do kind of a park and ride. Get, you know, direct routes into the fair from there. But that's a really fun one that's coming right up. Another one.
And is there a way to get there from downtown Eugene? Like, could you just public transit all the way?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, yeah, cool. The bus routes actually go from the Valley River Center, which is a little shopping mall that we have just north of town. And so that's kind of a popular, like, park and ride spot. Some cool opportunities with that. And they're actually in their 47th year this year.
So
it's, yeah, it's a really established, like, just kind of a cool event to check out.
And how many people does it draw every year?
Yeah. Well, let's see. Boy, I'd have to check on that number. It's a very well-attended festival, I can tell you that. It's, yeah, they, people come in droves to check it out.
You know us journalists, we like numbers.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, always happy to help with those. But it's, yeah, it's a special fair, for sure.
Okay,
really
cool.
Different, really unique. The other one that is also in its 47th year this year is the Oregon Bach Festival.
Okay.
Which is a really cool way to see you know, the different arts that take place here in Eugene. It's a really great way to kind of get a taste of the culture downtown too. It's in its 47th year, as I said, so the 50th year for both of these festivals is coming right up around the corner. So it's a cool year to kind of check both of those out and see what's new with them.
Yeah, that's great to know. And in terms of the one that you were mentioning in Eugene, I know you had mentioned earlier the urban wineries. How does that differ in terms of integrating the festival with the city?
Yeah, you know, I think the urban wineries do a really good job of kind of plugging into a lot of these events. And so they're kind of featured in a lot of them as, you know, different local wines. We're lucky that we have like some really high quality local wines, you know. And so you'll definitely find them at different parts of these festivals. You know, they're very active in terms of how they plug in.
And in terms of if you're just coming down and you're doing a downtown Eugene trip, are there opportunities to do winery production tours as well, or mostly just tastings?
You know, it's mostly tastings, but there are, like, King Estate is one that offers that really great production tour. They kind of showcase the facility there, and it's a cool way to get a behind-the-scenes look, especially at that big of an operation, to really see, like, how that works and, you know, how you can have, like, that same, you know, consistency bottle after bottle, but still have some cool creativity into it.
Cool. So yeah, in terms of creativity, like I think that in Eugene itself, there's a lot of cool things going on that people don't know about, but obviously you do have a lot of great things outside of the city as well. So for somebody who hasn't been down there and is thinking about a trip or trying to figure out if it makes sense to include in their itinerary, what's the one thing you would really want them to know about coming down for a visit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the one thing that really stands out, it's hard because we have the whole county, you know, but a lot of folks, when they're doing that day trip, they're coming down to Eugene, you know, and I think the big thing that Eugene has is just like easy to access outdoor adventures, you know,
and
that access to local food, I think, is pretty unique in Eugene. We have so many hikes and urban bike trails and things like that are, you know, they're well attended, but you won't find trails that are just like thick with people close to town.
Oh, that's really great.
To kind of dig in and get a good outdoor experience. But I'd say the same kind of holds true to some of our culinary culture too. You know, we have spots like Wildcraft Cider Works, who will be opening this new facility here. They're opening a new tasting room here pretty soon, later in the summer. And, you know, they're a great example of folks that are pulling from ingredients that are in Lane County and producing these amazing like dry ciders, you know. We have a lot of our local restaurants like Grit that are doing, you know, weekly menus on what's fresh farmers market. And you'll find a lot that really digs into the local food market, local food culture here, which I think is really cool to get experience.
Awesome. Well, I'm so glad we got a chance to chat today. This is great, and I can see some perfect little day trip itineraries and everything in here. And you've also given me some good ideas to dig into for my own trip. So I will circle back with you about that because it's not that long from now.
Yeah, I can't wait. Thank you so
I
much
know.
For the opportunity. It's great.
Yeah,
To
I'm excited, and it's good that we got to talk in this way beforehand as well. So I'll circle back with you on that. But just in brief, I think I'm going to be coming down Tuesday and then coming back up on Thursday, but it might be I'm coming on Wednesday morning and back up on Thursday, but I'll follow up with you on that over email.
Yeah, that sounds great. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, awesome. And thanks so much for joining us and sharing today with the group.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Have a great holiday. Bye, Stephen.
You too. See you.
Okay, everybody. Oops, I didn't switch the slide. So there's Steven's picture. So you can see Steven, who was just with us. So, all right. So I made a couple notes, more so with Steven than with Kristen, because I was just typing very, very quickly, of things that I wanted to pull out and highlight for you guys. So you'll notice that with both of them, and this is really common, especially when you're talking to people from tourism boards, but it also happens when you're talking to people about their own business, that you might want to be talking about a certain topic. You might have a specific idea of what you want your article to be about. And sometimes they just start talking about all sorts of things. So sometimes it's other things that are going on in the destination, or sometimes they're talking, you know, very in-depth about one thing that could be included in your story, but your story needs to cover a lot of different things or something like that. And in those cases, you do definitely need to take something they've said and turn the conversation a different way by using that question. And I mentioned earlier, and I have in the past couple weeks, that you don't necessarily want to have a list of questions that you want to ask about prepared, but you do want to have some things that you want to talk to them about. So for instance, like when I was talking to Stephen before our call, he had mentioned that there were some festivals that he really wanted to tell me about. So like even though we were kind of going long, I knew he wanted to ask about that, and I didn't want to get off the phone before we touched on that, so I made sure to pivot over and ask about that at the end. But some other things that I wanted to highlight were, there were some times where, especially in the second call, we were talking and he mentioned something and I was like, oh, can you tell me more about that? But sometimes I didn't just say, oh, can you tell me more about that? What you can often do is take essentially the sentence that they said and say it back to them and sort of say, you know, I'm trying to find a note that I made over here, and say something like, oh, they have different boats just for this river. That's very interesting. Tell me more about that. So that can be a really good way to get specific stories. Like when he was talking about how not only did they design these different boats, and he told me about how the speed of the river picks up and slows down, so they wanted a boat that could float differently and navigate the rocks well. Because I asked about that, I also got this really great piece of information, which is that a lot of the guides now are actually related to the people who designed these boats in the first place. So sometimes tidbits like that just come out. When I was talking to Kristen, she had mentioned that, I'm trying to find it up here, that the Purple Door Ice Cream was started by a husband and wife couple who talked about on their very first date that they wanted to open an ice cream shop. That's an amazing detail. That's really cool. But you won't always get those things right away. So sometimes you need to take something that the person had said and just kind of say, oh, da-da-da-da-da, which is repeating the same sentence they said, and say, tell me more about that. So another good example of that was when he was telling me about the fairs, I thought he said county fair on the first one, and I'm glad I asked again. And so I was kind of like, so tell me more about what it's like to go to that fair. And he was talking about that. But then I said, well, how do you get there? How do you park? Because what you can run into, whether you're talking to a person who owns their own company and they just kind of mention different products that they have or different wines that the winery makes, if you don't ask them why, if you don't say why do you make that wine, or like how do you actually get to this festival, you can miss out on the types of details that you as a writer really want to include. So for instance, for the country fair, it's really useful to know not only that they partnered with local transit and you can get there via local transit, but that you can even get there right from Eugene, which means that if you wanted to come down from Portland just to go to this festival for the day, you could take the train and then take the bus or the shuttle that they've set up over without having to rent a car just to go to this festival and park it all day, because who would want to get a zip car just to take it somewhere and park it? So those are a couple things that I had made some notes on as we were talking to highlight. As I was going through and listening, you know, I hear Stephen say that the 50th anniversary of these festivals is coming up. That's great. I heard that the winery has just become Service Biodynamic. That's another article idea. A lot of different things that I talked about with both of them are things that as I'm hearing on the call, I'm like, great, that not only works for the article I'm working on right now, but I can see making another article entirely just about this one thing. And on each of those calls, I probably heard 10 or 12 different things like that. And so that's the kind of thing that we look at in the webinar, and how to break your trips into the maximum number of pitches, and especially how to generate SureFile saleable ideas. And in the webinar on the magazine landscape and where all the magazine assignments are hiding, we talk about different types of magazines. So on the call with Kristen, I mentioned how, as we were talking about the restaurants and how they work together, and one of the reasons that I asked her a follow-up question on that is that I can really see these programs, and specifically a profile on Dave Swanson from Braze and how he's worked to really grow the culinary scene. I can see a profile on that working in a trade magazine for restaurateurs in ways that they can help grow their community and also boost their own business profile. So that's the kind of thing where often when you're talking to somebody, you can see not only how the things that they're telling you would work from a consumer application for your own blog, for different magazines, but you can very frequently flip those around into trade articles for people in that industry. So for instance, when Stephen was talking about the lighthouse, that's the kind of thing that it's a very unique opportunity for revenue for a historic building, and that might be something that could work in a magazine that's aimed either at historic hotels or historic locations, like Preservation, which is a magazine for about buildings in general that are renovated spaces. So with that, it was a pleasure chatting with you guys today, and I'm so sorry for all the technical issues, and I hope that at least this version of the slides is working for you guys. And I really appreciate you all joining me today, and I hope that you learned some interesting things from our guests and maybe got some story ideas of your own from there, as well as watching how to do an interview. So thank you so much, and if there's any more questions, I'll hang out for a little bit and grab those. So Carrie asks, is a press trip like a FAM for travel agents? Yes, a press trip is like a FAM for agents, Carrie, except the thing with press trips is that in theory, but not necessarily all the time, a press trip is conceptualized as something that's for people who already have an assignment. So they talk about how they confirmed assignments or letters of assignment. So in general, a press trip, especially a group press trip, would be for people who saw the trip, were interested in the trip, pitched an idea, had an idea accepted, and so everyone on the trip will have a story in play or an outlet that they can be planning to place a story in after the trip. I think that's everything. So thanks so much, you guys, and have a great holiday weekend, all of you. Cheers.